This podcast is brought to you by flexible working company Fora. Traditional offices may no longer be what workers want, but flexible workspaces like Fora can give the versatility that today's companies need. Not only can they be more economical, flexible workspaces can also have the amenities that employees really want. To learn more about how the old ways are being ditched for new workplaces, visit wired.uk/Fora. Coming up today, Natasha investigates the UK's broken housing algorithm, Matt Burgess reveals how universities are snooping on students, and Amit witnesses the grim demise of the cinema industry. Welcome to the Wired UK podcast, your essential weekly catch up on all the big stories in tech, science, business and culture. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Amit Katwala.
Hello.
Natasha Bernal.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Hello.
This was the week when Twitter and Facebook took unprecedented action to prevent people from seeing and sharing a controversial New York Post story about US presidential candidate Joe Biden. Twitter outright blocked it from being shared, while Facebook suppressed its distribution in the newsfeed.
This was also the week when British Airways was fined $20 million over its 2018 data breach, which impacted 400,000 customers. The data protection regulator planned to fine the airline at £183 million, but took the economic impact of the pandemic into account.
This is also the week when YouTube became the latest social network to crack down on the sprawling QAnon conspiracy theory. The company said it would ban material targeting a personal group with conspiracy theories that have been used to justify violence. The move follows similar steps taken by Facebook and Twitter in recent weeks.
And finally, more than half the population of England is preparing for tougher lockdown restrictions from midnight on Friday, as London and other high-risk areas enter COVID Tier 2. Millions of people will be banned from mixing with other households indoors, including in pubs and restaurants.
As we're all residents of London, I look forward to seeing you all maybe in 2022. We might squeeze in a quick visit to the pub. What have we learned this week? Matt Burgess.
This week, I learnt a fact about Venus. This was after rereading some of the sort of news from a few weeks ago about the discovery of potentially bacteria? I can't even remember what it was.
Just life.
Alien life on Venus.
Yeah
that's the one. Sort of. I learnt that a day on Venus lasts for 243 Earth days, while a year on Venus is 224 Earth days. So technically on Venus, a day is shorter than a year. Longer than a year. Yeah.
I guess if you lived on Venus, you'd come up with different ways of measuring time, because otherwise it would be confusing.
You probably would, but you just wouldn't live on Venus. That's the crux of it, really.
That is the crux. Natasha, what did you learn this week?
I learned about great wind. So when hurricanes hit, most animals can be killed or injured because they sort of fly away, but not these lizards called anoles, which have evolved to survive really fierce winds by using really long toes with big toe pads that are covered in ridges and hairs that give them a super strong grip on a tree or other perch. So these scientists analysed 70 years of weather records, and they found that if the lizards were based in locations where there were hurricanes, they would have longer toe pads, and if they were based in places where there were fewer hurricanes, they would have shorter ones. They can survive winds of 170 miles an hour, and human beings can survive 500 miles an hour, but without sort of things in their way, if you know what I mean.
Things in their way?
Yeah, like if you're in a hurricane, obviously you'd be smashing against things like debris, trees, rocks, you know, whereas if the way that they measured it for human beings is if, for example, someone had to use a jetpack and eject from an airplane, they could survive 500 miles an hour. So worse than a lizard, basically. If we had toe pads, though, that would be a game changer.
We'll get there. I've got another evolutionary fact. This one ended up going viral on Twitter after I spotted it earlier in the week, but I was there first, I promise. Crustaceans, it turns out, have evolved into the shape of a crab entirely independently at least five times. So while a king crab and a coconut crab look really, really similar, they actually evolved along completely different paths. So it turns out that everything ultimately becomes a crab, whether it wants to or not. Crabs just make sense. Amit, what did you learn this week?
I'd like to undercut all that whimsy and natural wonder with a deeply depressing fact about Uber. Uber has so many teachers working for it in the US state of Oregon that it now notifies riders when their driver is an Uber educator by putting a little book emoji next to their name.
That's there you go. Very cute and very sad, isn't it?
It's awful, yeah. Although, to be fair to Uber, they did donate 3% of the fare to a local school if your driver was a poorly paid teacher.
How heartwarming. Yes, well done, everybody. We've got a subscription offer, a super special subscription offer for podcast listeners. You can get the current issue of Wired magazine for the ludicrously low introductory price of £1. You then get the next six issues for the equally low price of £19. That's more than a year of brilliant Wired journalism for just £20. This is a limited time offer and it's only available to people in the UK and only available to podcast subscribers, unless one of you posts the offer link on Twitter. If you love the podcast and want to support what we do, then why not give the magazine a try? You won't regret it. Head to wired.uk/podsub1. Matt Burgess, that URL?
That is wired.uk, not .co.uk, wired.uk/podsub1.
And it's the numerical one, not the word one spoken out.
It is, and it's pod sub spelt in your normal way that you spell pod sub.
Thank you very much. Good stuff. Please do take us up on that, because it will be a miracle if any of you manage to understand us reading out that URL. Okay, first story this week, housing algorithms.
Yeah, it's fun topic. So no one is more fan of a good algorithm than this current government. Their latest attempt at a scientific sort of spreadsheet-based response to a big problem is the housing algorithm. It's created by the Ministry of Housing, and this algorithm has tried to perfectly allocate an annual house-building target to each region by factoring in demand, population growth, and local affordability. The only problem is it's already incredibly broken.
So, I mean, hooray, another algorithm that we can despair over. What's wrong with it exactly?
So it was basically designed to solve England's housing crisis, but it's choosing to build houses in the wrong places. It's setting astronomical targets for rural towns where there's low demand and city locations where the cost of land is incredibly high, while artificially slashing housing targets in the places where people need them most. So if the algorithm has its way, London and the South East will have hugely inflated new targets for housing, while cities further north will have their targets slashed to levels lower than their current output. So if, you know, it's just a kind of catastrophic disbalance of the kind of the situation in housing that is currently available. Even the Housing Building Federation, which is a trade group that supports most of the government's policy, says they've recommended changes to the government to make sure the algorithm actually delivers homes in the north. So these regional inequalities arise from the constraints of the algorithm itself and its heavy weighting towards demand. So if, for example, London generally needs three times as many homes as Liverpool, the algorithm basically determines that Liverpool's share of the new housing target would be roughly a third of the capital's, even though the figure doesn't actually match the city's needs. So let's take Manchester, which is currently in the midst of a housing boom. The homes that are being built over there at the moment are really expensive. Between 2016 and 2018, not a single one of the 14,667 homes were classed as affordable. But you see, if the situation is currently as it is with this algorithm, it's not just telling the city to not produce more affordable housing, but to produce 31% fewer new homes every year.
Yeah, we obviously have a lot of listeners to the podcast that are based sort of all around the world, lots of different countries. Could you give us a little bit of context in terms of like what the point of this housing algorithm was in the first place and sort of why it was considered needed in that sort of situation?
Yeah, housing has been considered basically a massive disaster for a long time. So it's been a bureaucratic nightmare where councils are sort of planning departments are faced with hugely angry residents who don't want anyone to build anything anywhere. So faced with opposition from them, local authorities have frequently struggled to even come up with a number of new homes that they need to build each year. And this algorithm basically allows them to get to that concrete figure. So people really need this number because local authorities were falling way behind producing any plan at all because there was so much argument over the basic number of houses they had to plan for. So the government chose 300,000 homes a year as an achievable target for the country. But that completely ignores the real demand. So it could be closer to 400,000 or 500,000, according to Jonathan Webb, who's a housing researcher for the Institute of Public Policy Research. And we spoke to him for this piece. He says that the problem with this algorithm is that it's so completely constrained by what the government perceives the housing need to be, that it's short of what's actually needed. And when you try to produce enough supply in London, you end up reducing the number of homes you build in other areas, and the problem is that those other areas still do need homes. So they've grabbed this 300,000 figure, they've said this is the target we're going to get. So the algorithm has then got that information, it's processed it and said, okay, we're going to slice up pieces of this pie, you can get some London, and then since London needs three times as much as the city, we'll give them three times as much, and you end up with basically nothing. And that's the big problem with this. It doesn't really necessarily factor in real life.
So it's bad data in, bad outcome out, something that we've seen pretty consistently with government-backed algorithms is that they reflect the biases inherent in society. So we're seeing in the UK, where in England at the moment, a bias around COVID-19 policies against the north and in favour of particularly London and the southeast. So what's going to happen on the ground if this algorithm is implemented? Because to be clear, we're still some way off this being used in the wild.
Yeah, that's right. So if it does end up as it is implemented in the wild, the whole sector in certain regions could be at risk. And while it's still uncertain whether developers will be stopped from building extra homes in northern cities, it does seem likely that government support for the industry will be given a significantly lower priority than it is right now. Experts are saying everything from tax incentives and funding to fast-track permissions and joint projects could be at risk. And the effect that that would have on local economies is devastating. And just as there are losers under this algorithm, there are winners too. So you forget that there's a massive market behind every single plot of land in the UK, with a huge drive of certain housing suddenly in random areas of the UK. The demand to develop new land will skyrocket. One of the examples that we used in the piece was Tunbridge, which is a relatively rural town, which would suddenly explode. It would be growing by about a tenth of its size every year under this algorithm's decided equation. So as a result, the value of the finite amount of land in very coveted areas would shoot up. And if you think about the way that the country is divided, almost half of the UK is currently owned by less than 1% of the population. And many of the landowners would do very, very well from any concentrated surge in house building. So if you don't distribute the amount of houses that you need across England, then you're going to end up going to just all the places that already are worth a lot of money and just paying a massive amount to develop any kind of housing in that area. So in places like Camden in London, which has been told to increase the number of homes it builds each year from under 1,000 to 5,604, very specific number, there's a very, very small bit of land available. And even if the government's newly proposed planning reforms manage to release more land for development, it's unlikely they could ever free up enough to account for a surge that high. So this kind of land inflation has other knock-on effects as well. In essence, the more expensive the land, the more likely that the housing built on it will be luxury and high-end. So this is the types of buildings that give developers bigger margins, and it completely defeats the point of the algorithm entirely.
I've got to say, I find this story absolutely bewildering. Like, I don't understand what the number of houses that are required in London has anything to do with the number of houses that are required in Manchester or anywhere else in the country, and why the government would be allocating a non-finite resource out as if it's a finite resource. There's no maximum number on the number of houses you can build in the, I mean, there is, but there's enough room to build all the houses we need in the UK. So I don't really see why they've decided to set what sounds like an arbitrary number of houses and then allocate them out to different cities when they could just build all the houses we need. Make it easier to build houses so that the market takes care of it. Bizarre. So, I mean, presumably the government has realised this and is going to scrap the algorithm, right?
No. So what you say about like why an arbitrary number is because the lack of affordable housing has been a problem for some time, and it's been that sort of bureaucratic block that stopped anything from happening sooner. And so they've put this amount out there saying, okay, people are desperate for housing, we don't have enough housing, let's see if we can make it happen. The algorithm, which is based on, doesn't have any of the context of where people are looking for, why putting certain houses in certain areas is a good idea and why it isn't, has decided arbitrarily to do this. But as James was saying before, this is still very much in its early stages. So it's at white paper stage, which means that it's far away from parliamentary vote, let alone being implemented. It's just not happening yet. And experts in the housing industry are just as confused as you are, Amit, about the exact ramifications of these housing targets. Many are saying they're really not sure what role the government would play in supporting or undercutting local development in affected areas. So if you have a private developer who decides to put thousands of houses in the middle of nowhere, is the government going to stop them because it doesn't fit into its 300,000 quota? Probably not, but no one's really clear on what's going on. So the Ministry of Housing at the moment is saying it's happy to update or refine the algorithm to help handle potential complaints. And politicians and industry figures have basically been jumping in and trying to fiddle with the calculations. Earlier this month, London Mayor Sadiq Khan offered his tentative support to the algorithm on the condition that different mathematical weighting would be applied to affordability and housing stock calculations. In essence, changing the formula of this algorithm completely to be more suited to the economic situation in London. So what he was saying was very much the argument of, you know, you can't plonk loads of houses in Camden where no one can really afford to buy them anyway. Let's put them in places where people could afford to buy them and make them affordable housing, make it actually work out, because we have too many luxury houses in the UK, in London anyway, that no one can actually live in when they're normal people. So given this government's history of U-turns, it really doesn't seem out of the question that the algorithm could be scrapped or really significantly altered before it's implemented on a sort of actual practical level.
And this could eventually form a part of quite a concerted effort that the government is currently going through to make the planning process easier or different, at least. A big problem at the moment, and there's a very local example to where I live in South London, of NIMBYism, of developments in disused buildings and local residents complaining about the number of units that want to be put into them. And the current planning process makes it all too easy for a very small number of objectors to delay a project, and on the flip side, for developers to try and push through developments that aren't what's actually required by the local area. So you can see the logic of bringing in an algorithm that is able to, without those biases and those complications of messy human beings, make or help make better decisions. But what we're saying is, again, bad data is coming in, so bad results are coming out. So, Natasha, a super simple question for you. Has there ever been a single example of an algorithm that's good for public policy?
Not really. So as you say, James, there's a lot of politics involved, a lot of opinions involved. And I think this government has been very prone to saying, well, if the algorithm, which is independent, it doesn't have political bias, is making the decisions, then it will surely be seen as independent and everyone will agree that it was fine. And that's just not been the case. So I think the biggest latest example of this going wrong was the exams algorithm scandal earlier this year, which we covered. It's perhaps the worst howler we've seen so far. For the first time, this algorithm was given the authority to dictate the grades of A-level students. For those of you listening outside of the UK, these are the grades that determine whether you go into university or not and what kind of university you go into. So it's hugely important bit of grading part of school. So it was a complete fiasco, and it was biased against students from state schools and people from diverse backgrounds, completely ruined the chances of many people being accepted in their first choice university, was scrapped after public outcry. We covered it extensively, and I do recommend you check out Amit's piece about it if you haven't already. But the housing algorithm and the exams algorithm are hardly the first of their kind. Early this year, police forces in Britain pressed ahead with widespread trials of facial recognition software, despite the fact that technology has been found time and time again to wrongly identify people as much as 98% of the time. It cannot identify people on the street, can't identify people who are wearing face masks or, you know, head coverings or have beards. it's flawed, and they know it, and yet they've still implemented it. And crime prediction software, which I believe Matt Burgess is very au fait about, attempts to work out if an individual will commit an offence in advance. That's been adopted by 14 police forces as of last year. And this is despite the fact that this software is allegedly unfairly biased against lower income and BAME communities. So the recurring theme here is an assumption that by just using an algorithm, you can find a completely objective solution to any issue. And all these algorithms have completely struggled when they've come in contact with the real world. That completely suggests otherwise. And what Webb was telling us earlier in this report was this is essentially the problem with all algorithms. They just reproduce human biases. So if you are giving it information that's horrible, it's just going to spout information that's horrible, and it's just the way it's going to go. So this housing algorithm, unless it's drastically reconfigured, is not going to work. It's going to be just the same fiasco as what we had with the exams.
A cheerful start to the podcast, and I can't guarantee that things are going to get any more uplifting over the next 30 minutes or so. So if you need a bit of a break, just put us on pause and go and do something fun. podcast@wired.co.uk with your thoughts on the UK's latest algorithmic fiasco, and please do read the piece if you haven't. We'll include a link in the show notes. Our second story, Matt Burgess, students screwed over by the exams algorithm, and now they've got another problem.
Yeah, so there's actually a nice sort of cohesion between the two stories here. Students that were impacted by that exams algorithm fiasco earlier this year, those were students that were taking their A-levels and heading to university for the first time. Now many of them are at university, and there is a whole new set of situations and events that they're having to deal with, much like the rest of us, but these are sort of new. Well, they're young people in new cities for the first time, and they are sort of going through, well, just for the context of what's been happening at a few universities around the country, most of the teaching in the UK is virtual. There's very little face-to-face teaching. I think there may be some in some places, but it's very much the sort of like the outlier of it is. But a lot of cases, universities have also seeing students quarantined in their dorms due to outbreaks. They've been fed food delivered by university staff, not been able to leave their accommodation a few months after going to university for the first time. And there's now a new aspect to all this as they start learning for the first time at university. They're being tracked digitally like never before.
Oh no, what's happening?
So this week we reported on the types of digital surveillance that students are facing. So universities across the UK are increasingly using a type of learner analytics tools to monitor students. This was a thing before the pandemic, so it's not brand new, but it is increasing as teaching, as I say, isn't happening in a face-to-face scenario. So analysis from Wired and from our reporter Chris Stoker-Walker on this looked at three popular learning analytics tools which are being used by universities, which track student attendance at lectures, if they were happening, but happening digitally now, library visits and more. So at least 27 universities around the UK are using this technology from three of the leading companies. There are other companies that are making these types of tools as well. But yeah, from our snapshot analysis, there are at least 27 that are using this. And really the sort of like picture of how much the tracking is happening is not very clear. So we questioned a lot of universities about the type of tracking or monitoring systems that they have in place to look at what students are doing and if they're attending and if they're watching lectures, etc. And there was very few answers coming from the universities themselves. But we do know from some of the information that we have that the data collection can be quite vast. So one university's privacy notice to students about one of the types of software that it is using to collect detailed information. It tracks how often students log into their virtual learning environment, if they click on any content, hand in any work, take out books from the library, access journals, view reading lists, print, scan, photocopy documents, log on to any computers that are owned by the university, and or attend lectures, seminars and workshops. And if the students are deemed not to be engaging with their education, then they may be contacted by a student support advisor or emailed automatically. There's emails that go out every 2 weeks, which will be to people that are deemed to be having low engagement with the university. And the National Union of Students, which is the body that looks after sort of student affairs from their perspective, Says that such tools are often employed with very little explanation of their purpose. There needs to be legal assurances in place to how data is being used and not misused. And there basically needs to be a lot more transparency around this for students to trust the universities that they are putting, that they're paying to attend, and also putting their sort of livelihoods on the line with.
See, I'm kind of in two minds about this, because I think I probably could have done with a bit more supervision when I was at university to deal with my low engagement, as you put it, Matt. But then on the other hand, I think any system that collects a list of what books people are reading is, I think, in the current climate, probably not a good thing to have. So I guess, can you kind of dig a bit more into like why this is a bad thing? Because I'm not sure it'll be immediately obvious to some people.
Yeah, I think that some of the there's some uncertainty around this from different perspectives. I think if you are a student or a lecturer or somebody that works at a university, you could see why there could be sort of like a suggestion of sort of too much data being collected and what's happening with that data. But there, it is also fair to say that universities have a duty of care over their students. It is a role of a university to make sure that the people that are paying to be there are going. And if they're not going, as you say, Amit, they might have valid reasons, or they might have reasons that they might need some extra support for sort of mental health care or other sort of considerations around their lifestyle. So it's not necessarily a terrible thing, but there are sort of like questions around sort of the around how much data is being collected. So at Bolton University, whose vice chancellor has admitted the institution monitors students through learning materials, library use, etc., their students union president there, they say that they are the students aren't being punished if they are missing or attending lectures, rather that the tracking system is used to check how long students are logged in for and to make sure essentially that they're doing their work, and that the university isn't using this data in a forceful way or any way to sort of punish people. And I think that's one of the sort of like big concerns around the reporting we did on this, in terms of like how these systems could be used to creep into like greater levels of surveillance. So some of the questions that were raised around this reporting is the systems are not really standardized. There are some sort of like guides around sort of the best practices for these types of software, but they're a couple of years old and they haven't been updated recently. And obviously we're living through very uncharted times of the pandemic, and these types of things will become more important if more learning does go online and virtual. And I think some of the really big things are just sort of, it's not really clearly spelled out how they use, or if there are any other methods to do this that you could be doing it instead. So there's also been concerns from some of the experts we spoke to around this, around like what happens to that data afterwards. From what we could tell, a lot of universities are not selling on any data or stuff like that. They're making it once a student leaves university, it's deleted. But there are sort of like concerns about this type of data collection and how going forward it could be potentially problematic if it became very normal and that data was then passed on to people.
And the reason this has become a real issue is because we're in the middle of a pandemic. All learning has gone online. As you say, a lot of these tools were already being used, but the amount of interaction that universities had with students that wasn't face-to-face was an awful lot lower. You know, you'd take a register if you wanted to check if they're attending lectures, or you'd get a vague idea if only half your class turned up. The problem here is that because these changes have happened so quickly and potentially with very little thought and oversight, that we end up introducing ways of behaving and ways of tracking people that we're not comfortable with, and the ramifications of that aren't fully thought through. So you talked about mission creep. Where could this end up?
Yeah, so there's one point as well that's worth mentioning around sort of like in the UK, some sort of attendance data is required by sort of central government home office areas for sort of immigration of students who are from overseas. So there's that aspect to it as well, which we didn't go into much in the piece, but it's something that's worth pointing out, that some of this data is required legally. So universities have looked at ways of collecting it, which they wouldn't do if people were attending and you could sign a register. So, but looking forward, there are sort of like some indications around how this could change going forward in terms of our relationship with technology. So the University of Buckingham, which is a private education institution institution has said that it's launching in 2022 a new type of degree there, which essentially uses a lot more personalization within the system, which could be a good thing in some cases. But it says that AI and intelligent platforms will monitor student engagement and understanding, helping staff to see where students are falling behind or need more materials to aid their learning. And I think one of the big things about this, as you say, James, is this is a different way of doing things altogether, and we sort of don't know how to interact with these technologies when the world is changing, and sort of what we're comfortable with is sort of being redefined as we go. But in the US, over the last few months, there has been a lot of monitoring through exams. So this is just one sort of like reported story from the Washington Post, but they were reporting around how webcams have been used by a lot of sort of online exams for people to watch, invigilators or people to watch that people are actually sitting and taking the exam. So a University of Florida student was feeling sick during one of her home exam tests over the last few months, and she asked the person who was at the other end of the system, is it okay to throw up at my desk? They said yes, and basically this person was ill during their test, didn't move because there were no bathroom breaks being permitted, and essentially she was sick a couple of times and couldn't sort of clean herself up or get rid of the situation until the test was finished and she was given permission to log off. So those types of that's obviously an extreme example, but those types of services and online testing in that scenario has been quite common in the US over the last few months. So it's a little bit like what we've seen as well with businesses monitoring workers when they're working from home and sort of like basically tracking a lot more metrics and performance. And I would say the key thing is probably yes, we need to re-examine some of our behaviors around these technologies, decide what we're comfortable with, decide what's appropriate for a time when we're living through an unprecedented crisis, and sort of reevaluate our relationship with technology in some cases.
If you want to glimpse the future, just look at America, where there are people vomiting in wicker baskets because they're not allowed to leave their desk because someone's spying on them through their webcam to make sure that they properly sit an exam under remote conditions. I told you it wasn't going to get much more cheerful. Podcast at wired.co.uk. How can we make good decisions about our relationship with technology when so much more of our lives are being lived online? What good examples of change during this time of huge disruption have you witnessed? Give us something positive to talk about. Podcast at wired.co.uk, or share something depressing if you're in that kind of mood. Our third and final story this week, Amit, is about the collapse of the cinema industry.
That's right, another cheery one. That's right, yeah. So movie lovers will have been reaching for their wicker baskets the other week when the big chain Cineworld decided to close all of its UK cinemas. The cinema industry in the UK is gasping for air. Admissions are on course to hit their lowest level since records began in 1928. Cineworld's closed. Odeon and View have announced that they're going to be scaling back their opening times to a few days a week. And all the kind of optimism around the release of Tenet has evaporated.
Why has this happened? Because it wasn't... Tenet, as you say, caused some optimism, but it disappeared pretty quickly. What was the big thing that made all the optimism disappear?
It's basically all James Bond's fault. So we sent a reporter, Stephen Kelly, down to the last days of Cineworld at Leicester Square. So he was kind of speaking to some of the staff there, and one of the people at the concession stand kind of said, you know, as soon as Bond was moved, we knew it was over. You know, we can't just keep showing the same films every day. So, you know, a lot of Cineworld staff have been let go. They've been promised that they'll be hired back once the cinema reopens, but they've obviously started applying for jobs elsewhere. They got to take, and this is, it's a great, very, very bleak detail from the story that will be up on Wired shortly, but they got to take the uneaten popcorn home with them. But, you know, as one worker said, popcorn won't pay the rent. And this all kind of stems, the latest kind of hammer blow to the cinema industry was where the James Bond film No Time to Die, which was originally supposed to be released in April 2020, and then was pushed back to kind of the December time, getting pushed back again to next year. And that kind of had like a domino effect. So No Time to Die led to the delay of June. Wonder Woman has been shifted from October to December. Black Widow has been shifted from November to March. And, you know, some big pictures like Mulan and Soul, which is a new Pixar movie, are going to bypass cinemas altogether, and they're going straight to streaming on Disney Plus. You know, some independent cinemas are kind of scrapping for survival as well, so it's not just the big chains. Some have closed, some are doing okay, but the industry now finds itself in a sort of surreal catch-22 where major studios won't release blockbuster films because they don't think people are going to the cinema to see them, but people aren't going to the cinema because there's nothing for them to watch. There's no blockbuster films for them to watch in the cinema. So there's this kind of grim feeling by the time that major studios hit upon, you know, the ideal release date, you know, when cinemas are ready to reopen, there may not be any cinemas left for those movies to go into.
Oh, this is all really grim. And I know we talk about View and Cineworld a lot and the big chains, but obviously you've got independent cinemas who don't necessarily have, you know, backup funds to have gotten them even this far. It's a really dire situation. And we were hearing a lot over the summer. You were reporting about how cinemas were reopening, how they were doing a lot about social distancing and making sure people were safe. Given the fact that people want a bit of a respite from the horribleness that is this pandemic, why aren't studios releasing their blockbusters? Cinemas were open, people were bored. Why didn't they just try it out?
Well, I guess they did. So Tenet was really like the kind of canary in the coal mine here, if that's the right analogy. I suspect it probably isn't. But it's kind of been this weird cycle of hope and disappointment. So cinemas, as you say, Natasha, did a load of work trying to make sure that viewers felt safe, you know, and they brought in like kind of social distancing and like, you know, special machines to kind of clean the seats in between screenings and things like that. And then when Tenet came out, it did really well in kind of internationally. It got $300 million internationally, which is, you know, kind of pretty good in the circumstances. But the problem is that it performed quite poorly in America with ticket sales of only $45 million. And that's partly because cinemas in two of its biggest markets, LA and New York, were still closed. And what that means is that although currently kind of globally 75 to 80% of screens globally are open, you know, Asia's open, Europe's open, Brazil's open, Mexico's opening, South America's open, because these kind of key markets of the United States aren't open, movie distributors are really, really reluctant to kind of release their films until they can get into that market, which I guess is, although maybe not the bulk of their kind of ticket sales, it's you know, the prestige market where, you know, the execs that are kind of in charge of whether or not to release these movies probably live and work, and that's the kind of environment that they want to be the first to see those films.
And there's also a problem with planning, right? Films need a good few months run-up of promotion and marketing, and you don't want one blockbuster to clash with another, so everyone gave Tenet the space it needed, but then you can have a sudden glut of all the blockbusters that we've been saving up for 6 or 7 months. So it's caused this problem where everyone's just continually kicking the can down the road to a point where maybe we'll go back into that normal cycle of blockbusters come out in this month and then not this month, and certain studios leave spaces open for others. We're completely out of that routine now. But not everyone is in trouble. There are some cinemas that are doing pretty well against the odds.
Yeah, exactly. So some independent cinemas, I think the ones that are kind of more community-centric, I guess, the ones that have really made an effort to kind of build links with the people that live nearby, are doing okay. So the Prince Charles Cinema, which is an independent cinema in London, has actually found itself having to hire new workers. That's partly because they've split their employees into kind of two separate bubbles, but partly because they're actually doing okay. And what some people have said to us is that this crisis is a kind of a symptom of an underlying condition that's been affecting the industry even before COVID, is that there's an over-reliance on these massive blockbusters to keep the entire industry afloat. You know, places like Odeon, View, Cineworld, you know, they rely on these big films. A few blockbusters account for 90% of the business, according to one distribution company. Whereas these kind of smaller cinemas, you know, they'll do things like, they'll do like screenings of old films, and they'll kind of, you know, do themes like weeks and things like that. So they've kind of got reasons to bring people in that don't necessarily rely on there being a kind of steady supply of new films. And, you know, by the same kind of note, some kind of smaller films, which probably ordinarily would have been drowned out by the kind of stream of blockbusters, have actually been doing all right. So there was a Russell Crowe thriller called Unhinged, which did very well. It brought in nearly £200 million at the box office. And it's been playing for a lot longer than it normally would have. A film like that would normally have been in cinemas for 2 or 3 weeks before it got kind of pushed out by something else. But it's been kind of running for 10 weeks. And it's been kind of growing over and over again, more and more and more. Whereas traditionally, you know, the opening weekend is the big one, and then things kind of tail off after that. This has kind of been, it's had that long appeal, which I guess shows that, you know, people are still going to the cinema and there's nothing for them to watch, so they're watching Unhinged with Russell Crowe.
And as we sort of like go forward, obviously sort of there are still many disruptions to the process of the film industry as a whole around the world. So whether that's filming or distribution or any side of that, even before it gets to consumers, what do we know about sort of like the long-term impact this is going to have on the industry?
Yeah, so this has been a real wake-up call for a lot of people in the industry. And I think one thing it's kind of maybe changed forever is this idea of the kind of exclusivity window that films get in cinemas. So this is that kind of, you know, normally 2 or 3 month period where a film that's released in cinemas will not be available to watch in any other way. And this is something that cinema chains kind of negotiate with distributors quite hard for. In response to the pandemic and cinema closures, film distributors are being able to be more flexible with kind of smaller chains. So one film called Rocks was in cinemas for just 2 weeks before it went to Netflix. And there was a big fight between Universal and AMC over Trolls World Tour, believe it or not. Universal kind of said, you know, we're going to put this straight to streaming, and AMC, which owns Odeon, threatened to never host another Universal film ever again. But they've made peace on this deal, which kind of reduces that exclusivity window to 17 days and cuts AMC into part of the profits from video on demand. So what we might see is that this kind of window of exclusivity disappears or kind of erodes a little bit, so that people have the option to go and see something in cinemas if they want to, but if people don't feel comfortable, then they will have the option to kind of stream it at home sooner. And hopefully that will be enough to kind of keep the cinema industry alive. And then I guess beyond that, you know, these blockbusters that are being delayed, they do still all exist. So there is going to be hopefully a kind of massive boom year, either in 2021 or 2022, when these films can actually all come out. And there's going to be some incredible, you know, films available to watch. It's just whether or not there's going to be any cinemas for people to watch them in.
You almost ended on a note of optimism. We were so close. And then no. Podcast at wired.co.uk, have you been paying good money to still go to the cinema and sit in a strange, socially distanced environment? Are you sad to see them close, or is this just an inevitability of the pandemic era that we're living in? And counter to that, would you pay £15-20 to sit down at home and watch big blockbusters like No Time to Die in your living room? Podcast at wired.co.uk. Please do get in touch with us about that story or anything else that we talked about on the show this week. You won't find the link to that one in the show notes if you're listening to this on Friday. It's published on Saturday, and you'll find the link on wired.co.uk. Time for a couple of your emails. Amit, you're going to take us through the first one.
Yeah, we've had a couple of emails at the end. So one is from Matt, who is a Canadian living in Sweden. He wrote in about the story that I did last week or the week before about the right stuff and the skill set required to be an astronaut. And he said it reminded him of a series on BBC called Astronauts, Do You Have What It Takes?, which was a competition hosted by Chris Hadfield, where they kind of put people through challenges and tests relating to being an astronaut, and the winner got a recommendation to NASA. He said it was really, really interesting to see all the different kinds of people and this incredible skill set kind of being required to be able to be an astronaut. A fascinating story, and I suspect a skill set that I do not have, unfortunately, despite my ambition to one day go to space. We also got another piece of feedback in from Tim, Katie and Jack, who say that the Wired podcast is a family favourite. They listen to it while driving and have learned so much. They said they love the casual but well-informed nature and look forward to each episode. They also wrote in about the right stuff, and it's a Disney Plus show, which is about the Mercury 7, which were the group of astronauts selected for one of those first American missions into space. But they wrote in about a group of women, and I actually didn't know this, so thank you so much for sharing this, because this was really, really interesting. There was a group of women called the Mercury 13 who actually outperformed some of the Mercury pilots in tests, but kind of weren't sent out because NASA and, you know, US senators didn't want the first people in space to be women. But this is a really, really interesting story, and I think there's a documentary from 2018 that kind of tells the story of these women. You know, they write that they should get a mention whenever the Mercury program comes up, and I definitely agree. They also ask for an update on the avocado seed sprouting, which I think was a Vicky Turk project, so we might have to wait until next week for an update on that.
We could just ask you about the magpies, Amit. Have there been any sightings in the trees outside your window?
No, there were some boisterous teenage magpies harassing some other birds a couple of days ago, but I've not heard anything from them since.
Good. Do keep us updated. And we'll check with Vicky, and I think she's growing chilies and avocados and all sorts of stuff. She's living the good life. Matt Burgess, printers.
Yeah, so we had a couple of emails again on the story about printers, which is one that Vicky was leading on last week. And these emails were both from Fergal and Mike. And just to sort of abridge, paraphrase a bit of both of them, they both said that they enjoyed the podcast. And it was... Fergal says that it's a little short-sighted to encourage investing in home printers without describing many downsides, such as the waste that the industry famously generates, and suggests that Fergal says that surely it's a good thing that we're moving away from printers, from lots of home printers, and printing less. And then Mike also added that there'll be consequences for the environment. Hurriedly brought cheap printers will end up in landfill as they are unreliable and expensive to run, and they will waste energy by being left on standby, etc. And I think that, yeah, I think those are both two very good points, and something that we didn't touch upon within that sort of discussion. But yeah, the printer industry is obviously one that can be very wasteful, and is one that probably could do a lot better in terms of its environmental impact. So yeah, good points. Thank you for writing in on those.
And they are just rubbish, aren't they? I mean, I listened to the podcast last week and I agree with an awful lot of the points you raised. But just to add, home printers are absolutely diabolically bad. And one final thing, Tim, Katie and Jack, thank you so much for telling us that the podcast is a family favourite. We don't often read out the nice little lines of praise that people send in, but that one really resonated. So thanks so much for sticking with us and listening to the podcast every week. It's good to have you with us. Do write in podcast@wired.co.uk. We love hearing from you. Please send in compliments. It makes us happy. We will see you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye.